Good evening. You.
You.
Yeah, you. You're listening to The Talking Show on K Chung Radio, Chinatown's only.
Only.
Only. Micro broadcasting radio station. I'm Nicholas Miller, here as always with the not-to-be-imitated Stephen Cato.
Hey, thanks for the introduction, Nicholas. My name is Steve Cato. Hi.
Oh, you know, I forgot to ask, Steve, now that you're a married man, is there any talk of hyphenating the last names or taking one or the other?
No, I don't think so. I think we're happy with our names as they are. You know, just before we went in. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I hear you. Oh, I hear you.
Is that a...
Well, this is a somewhat somber episode tonight, being that it is the final episode of The Talking Show to be aired under the Obama administration.
Oh, God, Nicholas, come on. Jeez.
Yeah. Doesn't seem like it's gonna come out any other way. It seems like an inevitability.
I mean, to what end are you even surprised about this? This is something that happens every 4 to 8 years. It definitely happens every 4 years that, you know, the Obama administration was going to come to an end. And so it was either going to happen in, you know, 2012, or it was going to happen in this year. It happened in this year. That's two terms.
Sorry. It seems inevitable.
I mean, it's inevitable. Like, it would be inevitable. And also, I mean, what part of Americans electing a moron seems improbable to you such that this inevitability is such a bum out? I mean, like, honestly, look at the situation. Look around you. There is no way this is surprising, really. And as much of a bummer as this is, you know, are you shocked that rich people want to hang out with rich people and appoint things and do things in the interest of rich people? Like, nothing about that is uniquely shocking. Also, Obama deported everyone, expanded the powers of the presidency so drastically that now that he hands the keys over to an actual maniac, you know, we have reason to be afraid because, like, he can kill American citizens extrajudicially now. It's bananas, and that's Obama's doing. So, I mean, like, honestly, he let Chelsea Manning go after she attempted to commit suicide twice. I mean, like, it's not enough for me, frankly.
That Donald Trump will be our president by the end of the week.
Yeah, he will be.
Moving on, in better news, you know, a small victory for the queer community. Earlier this week, the Cultural Heritage Commission of Los Angeles named a few new monuments, which means that the city will work in perpetuity to protect these sites, and one of which is the Tama Findlay House. Yeah. That's not going anywhere.
That's nice. Feel good about that.
Precisely. Yeah. Well, speaking of LA and heritage, tonight we have a very special guest who hopped the entire pond to one of his favorite cities, so it was easy to convince. Just to tell us a little bit about what it's like as a foreigner to move through this great city.
Oh, do tell.
Well, a particular kind of foreigner, an architectural historian. So, without further delay, the equally inimitable Rainer Banham.
Booyah.
That's Los Angeles.
You can always recognize it by breeze.
And that's me, Rainer Banham, crossing the road.
I'm professor of the history of architecture at University College London. And you might wonder what I'm doing in Los Angeles, which makes nonsense of history and breaks all the rules. Well, I love the place with a passion that goes beyond sense or reason. I come here as often as I can, but this time there's an added attraction.
Welcome to Los Angeles, the super city of the future, the metropolis of Southern California. For the benefit of discriminating visitors, this car has been equipped with the BetaCar Visitor Guidance System, courtesy of Pennywise Car Rentals and Sunset Gasoline. The clean gasoline.
Helps fight smog.
Now you're ready to go. Begin by following the signs for Century Boulevard so that you can concentrate fully on your driving. Switch off the guidance system when you hear the tone. Have a nice day, and here comes the switch-off tone.
BetaCar is a fiction, a joke tribute to Carl Baedeker, the father of the modern guidebook. A useful fiction. Devising a guide is a good way to explain a city, and Los Angeles needs some explaining, because it's normally regarded as an unspeakable sprawling mess, though not, certainly not, by me. So, where shall we send our visitor first? Soon Century Boulevard will link up with the freeway system, and some lightning decisions will have to be made, because the freeways are unforgiving. Shall we go 20 miles north to the beach cities for sun and fun and surf? Shall we go 20 miles northeast to you know where? Could we go 15 miles south to the cliffs of Palos Verdes Mountain? And the suburbia on top of it? Or would we better go 20 miles southeast to Long Beach and the poor old Queen Mary in retirement? And that ridiculous island with its beautified oil rigs? Or why don't we go 15 miles eastwards to downtown, where they actually have ancient monuments, like the old Pico building? And the Plaza Church, the traditional center of Los Angeles since the days this was part of Mexico. In fact, in this fairly normal type of tourist area, with a bit of history about it, you can actually walk about like a conventional tourist with a guidebook in your hand. Here, a visitor could get along without BetaCar. Alvera Street is a conventional enough tourist trap, an expensive flea market that you could find in any big city in the world. But outside here, in the Los Angeles beyond Alvera Street, is a city that is nothing like any other. Los Angeles is certainly unlike the London where I usually live and move and have my being. And it's as remote as Mars from Norwich, the city where I was born and brought up. You remember Norwich? That fine city in all the insurance calendars? It's your British standard cathedral city, with its cathedral in whose shadow I played manly sports, its marketplace and its castle, those surviving medieval walls and narrow cobbled streets, and the handsome houses with their Georgian porches. But Norwich isn't all history and glamour. I went to school in Nelson Street, bylaw housing and a red brick Victorian school, all run down and partly destroyed now. It stirs no nostalgia to go back there. But round the back, in the next street, there was an entrance where we queued up on Saturday mornings, waiting to get into a hall that has been many things, but in those days it was the Penny Pictures. And there, when we had the penny for admission, we were transported to Los Angeles. Because all those marvelous old Hollywood silence were made on location as Los Angeles was being built. I knew Los Angeles long before I got there. From Buster Keaton to Perry Mason and beyond, we're all familiar with the place already. Well, it's familiar in a way, but when you're there in the traffic on Century Boulevard, it can be pretty strange and nervous. On either side of you are streams of determined drivers. They know where they're going, but where are you going? Already you've gone under the San Diego freeway, and you're right in the middle of it. I wonder if Baedeker could have the guts to throw you in at the deep end like this.
We really ought to level with you. This guided tour isn't taking you to any of the tourist spots you might expect. Right now, you're entering Watts, because we believe that the discriminating visitor will want to see what the city of the future is doing to cure the evils of the past. As you look around, you could hardly believe it was the center of the worst race riots in the history of California. Since 1965, the local community and the city of Los Angeles have inaugurated a program to rebuild the Watts District, and you will see the results as you drive along. If you turn right at the junction of Century and the street that bears the hopeful name of Success, you will find that you are entering the Watts Redevelopment Project. One block down Success will bring you to 103rd Street, the focus of the riots. Make a left on 103rd and you're on Charcoal Alley. It may not be good looking, but you should have seen it after the riots. And before the riots. Watts was never all problems. There are some beautiful things here too. As soon as you cross the railroad tracks, watch out for a right turn on Graham Avenue. Around you go then, down the side of the tracks, and then narrow little 107th Street comes up on the left. At the end of that street, you'll surely see why we brought you this way. These are the famous Watts Towers, a do-it-yourself monument to man's craving for beauty, executed over a period of 33 years by Simon Rodia, an untutored genius from Rome, Italy. Enjoy your visit now. Switch off when you hear the tone.
And I'd bring any visitor here myself, too, and before I showed him anything else, usually.
But wherever we went first, Watts or not, the journey would be the problem. This is a huge city, 70 miles square. It's a long way from anything to anything. And when you get to it, your destination may not be a clearly defined location. And the means of getting there may look pretty alarming. 15 to 30 minutes high-speed driving on the freeways, which I personally find rewarding.
You see, I think freeway driving is interesting in itself. From up here, you see the most weird, extraordinary places and things which you can hardly see from down below. But you have to, you know, discover them for yourself. Because if you read about them in the guidebook, you'd have forgotten about them by the time you got there. And I honestly don't know how helpful the gentle voice of Baedeker would be. It could really be a distraction under these kind of conditions.
Coming up now on your right is the world's biggest toy and game factory. From here, Matt Mason's space toys, Hot Wheels cars, and Barbie dolls go to all parts of the free world.
And everyone would say, Barbie dolls, for God's sake, and look round for a better look, and sort of drift over in the next lane and prang some little old lady from Pasadena in her Boss Mustang, and bash, that'd be the end of a beautiful guided tour.
Driving the freeways is an experience in itself. How about a spot of motorized art appreciation?
Hello again. Ahead of you right now is the intersection of the Santa Monica and San Diego freeways. It's reckoned by experts to be the most elegant in the world. Get in the lane marked Santa Monica, but watch out for traffic. And remember that flashing a signal does not constitute any right of way. Stick to the lane for Santa Monica, and soon you'll be making a long, smooth sweep over the high, curving ramp against the sky. How about that? Isn't it the only way to go? Back to Earth again. Watch out for the signs for Bundy Drive South. Repeat, south. If you don't do this right, we'll never get you back on course. Then switch off until you've gone under the freeway.
And if you did get it all right, and really did get a kick out of it, then you'd be ready to enjoy anything at all in Los Angeles. So how about starting with something completely obvious? Griffith Park Observatory. One of the classic viewpoints for observing the city. But it's more than that. It's a familiar and beloved landmark to every citizen of the place, and to every persistent moviegoer as well. Remember Rebel Without a Cause and James Dean?
From up here, you have this fantastic view of the whole enormous city of Los Angeles. On a clear day, endless streets running away for miles and miles and miles to what looks like just plain, endless, boring American suburbia. But when you look into it more closely, then you realize it's really a very different kind of place.
The more you look into the layout of the city, the more you see that it consists increasingly of long lines of tall business towers threaded through a sea of little houses. The classic is Wilshire Boulevard, where only a line of parking lots separates the business street from the residential suburbia immediately behind it. So, something like a million Angelenos could say something you'd never expect to hear them say. I live within walking distance of my work. Thank you. strangely, you have to explain this to Angelenos, as I often find myself doing at University of Southern California.
In terms of form, Los Angeles breaks all the rules which have been deduced by town planners over the years from rules deduced from existing cities like London, like Paris, like Moscow, or wherever. It breaks all those rules, and yet I would maintain it is still, in spite of that, a great city and a significant city. Because I think that the form matters very little, and that you can build a city any shape you like as long as it works. And you say, works? Los Angeles works? Everyone tells you that it doesn't work. From the ecological point of view, we are told, and on very good authority, that there's much too much pollution. But I can think of much dirtier cities. Heaven knows, much dirtier cities than Los Angeles.
So, come the day when the smog doom finally descends, when the traffic grinds to a halt and the private car is banned from the streets, quite a lot of craftily placed citizens will be able to switch over to being pedestrians and feel no pain.
On a clear day, rise and look around you, and you'll see who you are. On a clear day, how it will astound you, that the glow of your being outshines every star. You'll feel part of every mountain, sea, and shore, and you'll hear from far and near a world you've never ever heard before. And on a clear day, on that clear day, you can see forever and ever.
See why they call me the Andy Williams of the Gray Line. He can sing better than I can, but I bet he can't drive a bus.
Parts of the text of Baedeker exist already, thanks to the bus tours. Let's hear what he has to say about this part of Wilshire Boulevard.
Very beautiful shops up ahead of us on through the American Mile. Right underneath us is one of the largest pools or deposits of oil in the whole Los Angeles area.
Float on oil it may do, but in town planning terms, it floats on single-family dwellings, business islands in a sea of domesticity. To look at all this from up here, you may not see much affinity between this ocean of houses and a city like London, yet the building history is really very similar. The famous Georgian squares are the true prototype for Los Angeles. Residential in intention, they were created by the breakup of big landed estates, like every suburban subdivision in Los Angeles. They were broken up for profitable investment, ditto in Los Angeles. And in both places, the houses were as thinly spread as possible. In 18th century London, that wasn't very thin. The houses stand shoulder to shoulder because everything moved on foot, and distances measured in living feet had to be short. Bloomsbury ended on a precise line, representing the furthest point the citizens were prepared to walk. In Los Angeles, the citizens had wheels and could travel further. Not originally the wheels of automobiles, but the wheels of the Pacific Electric Railroad and the streetcars that rattle through all those early silent comedies. The Pacific Electric is gone now. It finally died only a decade ago. But you can still find among the undergrowth the rusting rails that once tied the whole huge city together. So, in a city of good communications and apparently unlimited space, the citizens could gratify their obsession with single-family dwellings in their own gardens. Remember how in Watts there were no multi-story tenements. Even ghetto people have nice little houses. But what can Baedeker do about the city's obsession with private houses set in their own grounds? Send the visitor to gawp at a panorama of exteriors like the bus tours of film star homes.
Blackstone front, Mr.
Oscar Levant. And next to him on your left, sold 2 years ago, was sold by Mary Livingston and Jack Benny. It was their former home. And they sold it to Rosalind Russell, and the home sold for $280,000, and it's now the home of Rosalind Russell. To your right, the home of Mr. and Mrs. Harry Carl. You know her as Debbie Reynolds. And back on your left-hand corner, one of the wealthiest ladies in Beverly Hills and a very smart businesswoman as well as a fine actress, Miss Lucille Ball's home. Of course, Desi Arnaz used to live here, too.
Never mind the film stars and their private palaces. Lots of ordinary people came here and built unpretentious homes combining domesticity with the fantasy of their dreams.
Quite a lot of this good domestic architecture is in the style you can see here, if style you can call it. It's called Spanish colonial sometimes, or the mission style. You recognize it by its white walls, its arches, its wooden columns, and by these roofs of heavily twisted tiles. But I don't know whether it's really a style or whether it's really a frame of mind, whether it isn't a special kind of Los Angeles mass-produced fantasy for people to live in. Dreams, domestic dreams that money can buy, but dreams like the dreams of Hollywood.
Houses like this always bring out the Hollywood private eye in me.
Anybody home?
The other great style of domestic design is the California bungalow, which has now been exported all over the world. And this is the greatest of them all, the Gamble House in Pasadena.
I have to admit, one of the reasons I love Los Angeles is that I'm privileged to live in this house as a visiting professor at the university. And it really is a privilege. It's a great house. But it was built originally for the Gamble family by the local architects, Charles and Henry Green, finished in 1910. The Gambles lived in it until really quite recently when it was handed over to the university and the city of Pasadena. And here I live. And you live comfortably here. I mean, it's a big, showy house for a winter cottage, goodness knows. But, and it has these great generous spaces inside and all this wooden craftsmanship and stuff. But you can live comfortably here. It's a very, very romantic house, but it's also a really domestic one.
Great talents like Frank Lloyd Wright built houses in Los Angeles. That's his Ennis house. And this is the Health House by Richard Neutra, one of the most advanced in the world in 1930. And here, over the ocean in Pacific Palisades, is the house that really taught the world's architecture lovers to come to Los Angeles. The house that Charles Eames, the great chair designer and filmmaker, created in 1949 and showed the world that machine-age materials like glass and steel could be beautiful, even pretty, and make a proper setting for beautiful objects. The Eames house is private. Nearly all the good architecture is private. And this expands into a major problem for the tourist.
Palos Verdes Mountain, with its tree-shaded streets, is one of the most exclusive residential areas in all of Los Angeles. Its layout is a veritable labyrinth of picturesque mountainside drives. And it's very easy to get lost. So have a map handy. Not all of the roads marked on the map are open to the public, so you should watch out for warning signs or flashing lights at the guard posts around the city of Rolling Hills.
Can I get through to San Pedro this way?
No, Mom. No, sir, you cannot.
Well, there's a road on the map.
Yeah, but this is a private road. You can't get through here.
I didn't know there were any private roads.
This is the city. They got a guard at every gate. They have guards here 24 hours a day at four different gates, 8-hour shifts.
Really?
Yes, sir.
Well, if you live there, how do you get in?
Well, you got a sticker. If a resident, or if you have somebody's business, but just to go through, I can't let you through.
I'd have a passport.
You'll have to turn around and go back to Crenshaw. Another way to get San Pedro. I'm sorry, but that's the way it is.
Okay.
That's my job.
Uh-huh.
That's one of the things I don't love about Los Angeles. Private cities you can't get into. You know, when you have a place like this, which is a sort of good imitation of a terrestrial paradise and the appearance of a free society, and then you have guarded gates and so on. It's like the Balkans before 1914.
Rolling Hills is a little defensive kingdom that keeps strangers out. But Los Angeles has really wide open communities as well. This is Venice Beach, where all sorts and conditions of Angelenos have come to find themselves and make a way of life. Of course, it wasn't built as a communal crash pad. It started life as a romantic suburb like any other. Abbot Kinney, its founder, wanted to create a replica of the other Venice. Some of it got built. Then they struck oil. After that came the Depression. Still, he made his canals, and his Venetian bridges still survive. Nowadays, people come here when they drop out, give up, or just change their minds. It's a relaxed sort of community, but it can be a violent one as well. It's a melting pot, socially unstable. It makes staid citizens and businessmen nervous. And the police. But there are gentle people here as well. The fine arts squad, working out fantasies like Venice in the snow on the walls of buildings. And there are muscle artists working out fantasies on their own bodies.
Well, I train every day, 6 days a week, about an hour and a half a day. And we break it up into different muscle groups, like chest one day, work the back one day, shoulders one day, arms one day. Just so it works in a cycle, so that you work each muscle every 2 or 3 days, and it keeps you physically fit. Then you follow a good diet, such as lean meats, eggs, cottage cheese, salads, fruits, and eliminate the carbohydrates and starches, which it all works hand in hand for a healthy body and a healthy mind. Venice is nice. It could be improved, I think, and they're cleaning it up slowly, and probably in the next 5 to 10 years it'll be a very nice area to live. It's improved a lot in the past couple of years, I think. It can improve a lot more. But it's a lot of nice people around here. Everybody knows everybody. It's very easy to make friends. Everybody has the same common interests of weight training and physical fitness. And it's the biggest thing now is coming up, all the health food stores and health food fads. So it's a common interest among many people, and it keeps peace.
I think Venice might be the point where I could actually disagree with Baedeker.
The new municipal auditorium, with its handsomely planted park, is the beginning of an urban renewal program that will transform Venice. Traditionally, it has been a home for artists and writers, and many of their picturesque homes will surely survive. But the dropouts and problem people who have moved into the area in recent years have made a cleanup necessary.
Yes, but where could all those people go?
What the future holds for Venice, as the dirty abandoned canals are cleaned up, will probably look something like the spanking new yacht harbor of Marina del Rey.
Ugh, another executive ghetto, plastic people in plastic boats.
Along the ocean front with its magnificent beaches, derelict old Pacific Ocean Park Pier will be replaced by a new apartment venture right over the surf.
Hey, hold it, that's heresy. This was the greatest pleasure pier in the world. I have picture postcards to prove it. And it wasn't derelict. It was deliberately bankrupted to make a real estate bonanza.
Other new developments will surely follow as Angelenos rediscover the pleasures of living right on the ocean or along the romantic old canal. To get the flavor of these possibilities, we suggest that before going north to Malibu, you visit the new marina and see for yourself the attractions of waterside living.
No, thank you. You go to Malibu. I have an appointment with something much more interesting right here in Venice, in a big tin shed about 10 blocks away.
It's not a factory. It's the studio of Vasa Mihalic, a Yugoslav sculptor now settled in Venice, where a number of artists have discovered that a big old shed is a good place to work. Out of this workshop come some of the most beautiful abstract sculptures I've ever seen. To produce that kind of art, Vasa uses the sort of craftsmanship that goes with power tools, advanced plastics and space-age chemistry. A sort of craftsmanship that now seems native to Los Angeles.
Those transparent columns of yours are really fantastic. Now could you have done this outside Los Angeles?
I hope so not, but I think
It's very convenient to do them here.
Why? Because the technology is
here. Yeah, everybody thinks it's technology.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe I'm wrong, but I think it's a town. See, in this town you really feel, at least me being European by background, you feel kind of like a free, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You can do crazy things and get away with it.
Ah.
You even can find some crazy people which will buy this too.
You mean there are people here mad enough?
Yeah, you will find this, you know. And yeah. This kind of freedom, let's put it this way, artistic freedom,
yeah.
To be specific, you just find here.
Mm-hmm.
It's a light, it's a people, it's a space, it's a wild town. I just feel here, kind of like a fish in the water. I mean, I'm not afraid of anything.
Across the USA, then everybody'd be served like California. You see them wearing their baggies, Warachi sandals too, a bushy blonde hair, serving USA.
There's just no other feeling in the world that compares with taking off on a clean 7-foot wave, crouching down and feeling the force of the wave just spraying your back as you come firing out. It's just the greatest thing in the world, and I wouldn't trade it for anything. I've lived in Hermosa Beach all my life. Hermosa's been known as kind of the surfing capital of the world because all the main manufacturers are in Hermosa Beach.
Vaz's assistant used to work in a surfboard factory like this. The new craftsman moved between art and industry in a real freemasonry of talent. And what holds the whole thing together, artists, craftsmen and sportsmen, is a common admiration for high finish and high style. Just look at the paintwork on these vans. And you can do wild things inside vans. Like play the piano yet.
I'll come running, yeah, to see you again. Into spring, summer, or fall. All you have to do is call, and I'll be there, yes, I will.
Inside and out, vans get this loving attention because they're the new thing in California, a new mobile private lifestyle. And if you don't believe me, listen to Brad, the mobile musician.
Well, I find that at this particular point in my life, living alone and living very independently is really very comfortable. It's very happy. I spent 3 years prior to getting this van. I was living in a house with a lot of people. It was a commune, and it was great, and I really enjoyed it at that particular point in my life. And I got to the point where I really wanted to play the piano a lot. I just wanted to play all the time and sing and make a whole lot of racket. And I found that you couldn't do it at a house like that. Other people wanted to play, other people wanted to play the record player, other people wanted to sleep, whatever it was. So I couldn't do what I wanted to do. So I just decided I need a place that's really private where no matter how loud I yell, I'm not going to bother anybody. And even a private apartment doesn't provide that because you've got the people all around you, you know. So I just decided this is where it's at. I'll just stick it in the van, and I can take it where I want to, be close to nature when I want to, and make as much noise as I want to when I want to. So it's an extremely private life if I want it to be.
Our next stop is at the Grauman's Chinese Theater. The theater was opened on May 18th of 1927. Just prior to the opening of the theater, Mr. Grauman, accompanied by Mary Pickford and Douglas Fairbanks Sr., drove up in front of the theater to view the construction. And that morning they had placed the sidewalk there in front of the theater, and when they stepped out of their limousine, they stepped right into wet cement, and that's the way they got the idea for the hand and footprints.
Hooray for Hollywood, that screwy ballyhooey Hollywood, where any office boy or young mechanic can be a panic with just a good-looking pan. And any barmaid can be a star maid if she dances with or without a fan. Hooray for Hollywood.
And Hollywood, through the big screen and the little screen and the long playing record, is the medium that has transmitted all that Los Angeles high style to the world.
A truly great city also offers a man a mechanism for imposing his own style and his own vision on the rest of the world. It was for this kind of thing that the young William Shakespeare came to London. Came to London already choking in a pall of coal smog, already riddled with VD and violence, a rotten city in many ways, but the only place where a young dramatist could make it and get his style through to a larger public at that time. It was for this kind of reason that generations of painters were prepared to starve romantically in the garrets of Paris. It takes a city to support style and craft, but it takes a very great city indeed to impose that kind of style on the rest of the world. And from the Hollywood movies, to pop art, to custom car painting, to the design of surfboards and so on, Los Angeles has done just that.
Right then, a city whose public buildings aren't very good, whose good architecture is rather private, and its other goodies either mobile or being used by somebody at the time. What on earth should the visitor go to see? I called a meeting in Tiny Naylor's drive-in restaurant on Sunset Boulevard and put the question to two of the local talent, Ed Ruscha, painter and photographer of the scene, and Mike Salisbury, art editor of West magazine, the local colour supplement.
I can help you.
Yes, please. Right. Thank you. Can I just have a pineapple sundae?
Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
And our BLT.
Okay.
On toast.
That be all?
Yep. For the moment. Thank you very much. She's really good at it.
Well, she sure is. Yeah, mm-hmm. Real.
There you are.
Thank you. Right, someone pass me my sundae.
I think it's going to take three hands here.
And a spoon. And with luck, we're away.
Can I speak for you?
Right, thank you.
Yeah, maybe a straw. You got a straw there.
Now, when you're ready, our problem is this, that we're talking about a town that has no public monuments that are worth visiting. But there are plenty of public commercial buildings here that we could send a visitor to see. Now, what sort of public commercial vehicle should we send people to see? Mike?
Well, this one's really a good one, I think, because it's not only the last of the drive-ins, it's probably one of the best.
It's the drive-in to end all drive-ins.
Right.
Ed, you know, what should people see?
Maybe gas stations, maybe.
Just gas stations?
Well, any kind of edifice that has to do with the car.
Mm-hmm.
And a gas station is one of them.
I mean, Yeah, but what are the particular virtues of these buildings?
Well, I like the fact that they can just knock them, just put them together in about 3 days,
mm-hmm.
you know, or less.
Mm-hmm. And
sometimes it takes longer to tear down an old building than it does to put up the new one.
Right.
And they're streamlined. Everything about it is streamlined. That's what I like.
And is the standardization a virtue?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. I like the fact that they can just put something up and get right to business, and you know that they don't want to lose any time.
Yeah, but from the observant visitor's point of view, it means you can visit the same building in 900 different locations.
Yeah, but you're not sure it'll still be in the same location when you come back again next year.
But, I mean, drive-ins and things aren't standardized like that.
This isn't. But what's happening is they're being replaced either by gas stations, which are, or a new kind of restaurant, which used to be only in other parts of the country where they couldn't afford to do this, and mm-hmm. now they can't afford to do this anymore.
You think the fantasy has gone out of it?
Mm-hmm.
Uh-huh. And maybe there's a sort of tradition of fantasy in these kind of places locally, isn't there?
Well, there is. That's why they were, the whole reason they were created. I mean, people really believed the California kind of mystique.
That hot dog stand should look like hot dogs, eat.
Right.
The fantasy of these buildings that appeals to Mike Salisbury so much is an old established California fantasy, a belief that absolutely everything is possible, even a restaurant in the shape of a bowler hat. And the Brown Derby was built as far back as the early 20s. Filling stations, drive-ins, hot dog stands, car wash plants, yes to all those. But there are also complete districts that seem designed as drive-in scenes.
Sunset Strip, the section of Sunset Boulevard between Hollywood and Beverly Hills, is entertainment land west. During your stay, you'll probably want to visit the famous clubs, the go-go girls, the topless shows, and the great rock music.
LA woman, LA woman, LA woman's on the avenue. LA woman's on the avenue. LA woman's on the avenue. Jive to your suburbs.
But since you're here now, and almost certainly stuck in the traffic, or reduced to a walking pace, look up at all those crazy advertising signs. Aren't they fantastic? They're like an outdoor art gallery. Tom Wolfe, the writer, called them electrographic architecture. People love them and people hate them. But billboards by day and night are some of the greatest sights the city can show.
Sodom and Gomorrah, cried the preachers of ecological doom. Earthquake, fire, flood, and slow poisoning by smog perpetually threaten the city. There's a sense of impermanence about the whole place, and yet its threats are also, in many and strange ways, the making of its splendors.
And now, at the end of your sightseeing day, you are headed towards the ocean and one of the most famous and best-loved sights in all of Los Angeles, the sunset. That view of the sunset is like a symbol for all the romantic aspirations of our city. We have named everything from bars to boulevards after it. God gave us the sun and the ocean. But the colors come mostly from the fumes and pollution that we ourselves pump into the atmosphere every day. enjoy it. The best of it doesn't last long. And then drive safely to your motel. On behalf of Baedeker Visitor Guidance Systems, we would like to wish you good night and hope you will come visit with us again. Here comes the tone for the last time. Have a good evening.
Ah, thank you, love. I couldn't have put it better myself. You know, that moment when the sun goes down beneath the Western Ocean, because it's got nowhere else to go. That great moment of plastic, fluorescent spectacle, sun going down in man-made splendor. That really is, to all us lovers of Los Angeles, the greatest exit line any city could ever have.
What do you think of that Baedeker, Steve?
I thought it was great. I think that it's nice that the man who, you know, invented the word cybernetics has, you know, like the world's first self-driving car, you know, or a sentient car. I like that. I like that he's got an AI in his car and it tells him what to do. I think that that is, you know, a conceit that I kind of glanced over the first time I saw this trick of Rainer's, and now he's got the car. He's got this thing that, you know, Silicon Valley's been working on forever, and now he has it. So I think that's like a fascinating matchup of critic and technology, you know. And he's a lucky guy to have it.
Yeah, definitely the progenitor to something we have today. Although, you know, it was kind of an art fad for a minute there to do these walking tour things.
Yeah.
You know, like an audio tour of, like, say, Echo Park Lake or some historical site or something, and it was about uncovering a history. I'm surprised people haven't made them for the car.
Yeah.
You know, like, nobody's done the Baedeker thing where it's, you get in the car and you drive around, they time it all out so that's an audio tour that's kind of self-derived. I'm sure it exists. Maybe I just haven't been paying attention.
Well, likely. I can imagine.
Oh, that reminds me of that excellent audio tour you did of the Mark Leckie show.
Well, thank you.
I think that piece cannot be praised enough, Steve. That's one for the history books, I think.
Well, it's a hard piece to see. You need a whole Mark Leckie exhibit at the Hammer first to see it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. I'm glad you caught it while it was around.
Yeah. Speaking of arts and Mr. Banham, it was pretty great to hear him chatting with old Ed Ruscha.
Yeah.
Of course, Eddie loves those gas stations. and the editor of West Magazine? I don't know West Magazine. Do you know West Magazine?
I don't think West Magazine exists anymore. I think it might have been folded into California Living or Sunset or something like that. But it is really nice to see people kibitzing at a hamburger stand, you know, kind of the way you'd imagine people kibitzing at a hamburger stand, you know? It's nice.
Right.
It's nice that some things don't change.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. Well, let's get the tough stuff out of the way. What was with this term of Banham's ghetto people? It didn't seem to bear any relation to hip hop music, of course. I think it was just his term for people in poverty. Was that your understanding?
Yeah, I think so. I think a lot of ways that people have of discussing underclasses, let's say, if we want to try and smooth that out in a more technical sense, we're not particularly well developed. I mean, if you think to, I know we've covered it already, but Trump's use of the word the inner city as a, dog whistle word for poor people of color, largely,
Yeah.
We haven't come that far.
Yeah.
You know?
Although I will say he did have a decent view on the so-called gentrification of Venice. And guess what? He was right.
Yeah.
Although the idea that people in LA would someday want to live or at least occupy all inches of the coastline, the beach line, is not a huge surprise.
No, I mean, I wasn't shocked about that way of thinking. And it's amazing in some ways that so much of it still remains available, like, Redondo Beach and San Pedro and stuff like that. You can live very close to the beach and not have too crazy a house, too much real estate leveraging. So it's interesting, really, that there's still so much available. Right. Yeah.
Yeah, it was... there was that bit where he encountered the private roads of Palos Verdes.
Yeah.
I mean, I've driven through Palos... I guess I haven't driven through Palos Verdes technically, but I've driven around there on the way to San Pedro. I've not encountered this private city. Have you, in your many, many trips to San Pedro?
I have never run into... I don't go through Palos Verdes often to get to Pedro, so I think that can be explained. There is a gated community in, like, mid-city that I... of course, I've never been admitted to, but that I drive by or bike by often, because just beside the gated community is actually quite a good bike route. If you were going to West Adams or what have you from, parts east and parts north, pretty great. I mean, I can imagine that Southern California would be a pioneering place for gated communities somehow. I feel like there must be a lot in Orange County as well. Maybe that exhibits a prejudice on my part.
Right.
But
yeah.
Do you think?
That was a pretty thorough tour.
I was
fairly pleased. I guess one thing that Mr. Banham and Beta Car leave out would be the San Gabriel Valley. But I guess that's not technically L.A., although neither is Palos Verdes.
No.
Anyhow... any proper auto tour of LA County should include the San Gabriel Valley and its many eateries and treasures.
Oh, God.
Wouldn't you say, Steve?
Oh, Lord. I'm dreaming of my next indulgence in that place. I think that one thing we can say about the San Gabe, and like the book Banham wrote, obviously is more thorough. He talks about the San Bernardino Valley a lot. In his book on Los Angeles. So I imagine that this is the kind of thing that just got left on the cutting room floor at Granada TV in the UK or for whomever he made this program.
Well, using Banham's words, maybe he thinks that the SGV is too full of dropouts and problem people.
Or maybe that.
Anyhow.
Yeah, who knows?
Good morning, Chinatown. Wake up.
Hola.